helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel. Believe it or not, the constitutions of both the United States and the several states provide ample tools and opportunities for we the people to protect our rights. That doesn't mean that those in government aren't looking for ways to get around those pesky supreme laws, but that the American people have the tools to stop them, and if necessary, reverse their bad actions. Constitutional amendments, lawsuits, telling our hired representatives what we expect them to do, even the militia are just a few of the tools we have readily available. The question I have is, will the American people pick up those tools and use them, or simply sit back and watch, yea, even cheer, as the Republic devolves into the Empire?
So this is how liberty dies, with thunderous applause.
Hello there, everyday Americans. Paul Engel here with the Constitution Study, where we read and study the Constitution. We teach the rising generation to be free. Why? Because the Constitution of the United States, it is the big tool. It is probably the primary tool that we can use to protect our rights. Yes, the constitutions of the states also play a big role, but as the supreme law of the land, the Constitution of the United States, well, it's the heavy equipment. It's the tool that we can use so often to protect our rights. Sadly, most Americans don't, generally because they don't know what it can be used for. Or otherwise, they don't think that it works anymore. I was having a conversation with a gentleman yesterday. By the way, a gentleman who which I believe I disagree on several points, but we were having an interesting conversation about the Constitution and the power that it has if we'd only pick it up and use it. Now, there are a lot of people today that are looking for anything to grab onto. They're people after a ship sinks, you know, after the Titanic. They're looking for anything to grab onto to keep them afloat. Sometimes I think they grab onto good things. Sometimes I think not so good things, but they all seem to be looking for something. Now, one of the things that a lot of people are glomming onto, a lot of people are reaching to, thinking this will save the Republic, is a convention of the states, or as some people call it, a constitutional convention. Now, personally, I tend to not use the constitutional convention language, not because it's inaccurate, but because it brings to mind the constitutional convention, where the Constitution was drafted. And that opens the mind up to all sorts of things that a convention of states doesn't really, doesn't have the power to do. And I tend to think a convention of states is a more accurate description, because that's really what it is. The states have petitioned Congress to call a convention for the states. This all comes, by the way, from Article 5, which is where we have the amendment process. Now, why am I bringing this up today? Well, Representative Jody Arrington has proposed a resolution that would call a convention of the states, a convention for the purpose of proposing amendments. So if we're going to understand this, let's go to Article 5, where all this happens. We start with the Congress, whenever 2/3 of the both houses shall deem it necessary, shall propose amendments to this Constitution. So this is the way that we've so far amended the Constitution. Congress, both 2/3 of each House of Congress, have made a proposed amendment to the Constitution. But it goes on. Or, on the application of the legislatures of 2/3 of the several states, shall call a convention for proposing amendments. All right, this is the other way, which is why I say a convention of states, a convention for proposing amendments really would be the best way to refer to this. So we have two ways of proposing amendments. You have the Congress can propose it when 2/3 of the of each house make such a proposal, or when 2/3 of the states say, hey, we want a convention for proposing amendments, Congress then calls the convention for the purpose of proposing amendments. Now, the convention itself then has to go through and whatever organization process the convention comes up with to determine when it's going to propose an amendment. But there's an important piece to this we need to remember. Continuing in Article 5, which in either case shall be valid to all intents and purposes as part of this Constitution when ratified by the legislature of 3/4 of the several states, or by conventions in 3/4 as the one or other mode of ratification may be proposed by the Congress. So that's the process. Either Congress proposes amendments, the states ask Congress to call a convention to propose amendments, but those amendments don't mean anything until they are ratified by 3/4 of the states. Now again, a lot of people, generally the ones that like to call these this a constitution convention, warn, oh, they're going to rewrite the Constitution. Well, I suppose while technically possible, it really is highly unlikely, as in fractions of a fraction of a percentile likely, because they have to get approval from 3/4 of the states. But Paul, they say, the Articles of Confederation were simply changed by a convention. Only after the states agreed to the Continental Congress proposing a new constitution with the proviso that the states had to ratify the change before it took effect. So unless a significant number, unless basically 3/4 or at least half of the states say, yes, we want to completely rewrite the Constitution, I don't think they're going to rewrite the Constitution. They want to propose amendments. So let's take a look at this bill for a moment. It's a fairly simple bill. It's actually a concurrent resolution calling an Article 5 convention for proposing a fiscal responsibility amendment to the United States Constitution and stipulating ratification by a vote of we the people and for other purposes. All right, here's problem number one. Congress has zero authority to determine what amendments will be proposed. Congress's only purpose in this part of the process is to call a convention. When 3/4 of the states when 2/3 of the states say we want a convention, Congress calls a convention. That's it, nothing more. Now, if you read some of the nonsense coming out of the Congressional Budget Office, they claim they have all sorts of powers. It's not there. Why? Because it doesn't exist in the Constitution. If it's not in the Constitution, it's not a power Congress has. So when they say here that they want to propose a fiscal responsibility amendment, that language probably comes from the CBO and their wish list that Congress can control what happens in here. Again, that's all stuff made up out of whole cloth. Congress's only authority is, okay, if 3/4 have, if 2/3 of the state have asked for it, the state legislatures, go ahead. So the resolution points out that, you know, Article 5 says on the application of legislature two-thirds of the several states, Congress shall call a convention for proposing amendments. Very simple, cool. Now, it goes on. Whereas congressional and state records of plenary application for amendments of on any subject, an application for the single subject of inflation-fighting fiscal responsibility amendments compiled by the Article 5 Library, counts Nevada's continuing application reported February 8, 1979, in the Congressional Record as the 34th and thus achieving the 2/3 congressional mandate to call the convention for proposing amendments, Congressional Records reported 39 applicants by the end of 1979, 40 by 1983, and 42 total applications over time. Now, this is where things get a little interesting because I've seen these numbers before, and every time I've seen these numbers, they ignore legislators that have rescinded their call for a convention. And that gets to an interesting debate. Some people claim you can't rescind your call for it. It's kind of like getting pregnant. You can't simply rescind getting pregnant. Well, I guess in this day and age, you kind of can, but go with the analogy, right? That states, once they make an application, they cannot rescind it. They cannot recall it. But we're going to talk a little bit more about that in just a minute. But there's one other piece in here. Again, there's a couple oddities in here that are focusing on different things. But the one that caught my attention was this one. Whereas the Supreme Court's unanimous opinion in Schiaffalo versus Washington stated, electors have no ground for reversing the vote of millions of its citizens, that direction accords with the Constitution as well as the trust of the nation that, here, we the people rule. Okay, I'm trying to figure out where Schiaffalo enters in here. So Schiaffalo versus Washington was a question about faithful electors. If an elector, could electors vote in a way other than what they had pledged? That, by the way, comes from a twisting of our presidential election system where people are tricked into thinking they vote for a candidate when they're actually voting for an elector. And they've asked that elector to, that elector is pledged to vote a certain way. And the question is, could if the state law doesn't require the elector to follow the votes of the people, could they change it? What that has to do with an Article 5 convention, I have absolutely no idea, other than we the people rule. It's something about that. So now we get to the active part of the legislation. As provided in Article 5 of the Constitution of the United States, and except as provided in Paragraph 2, Congress hereby calls a convention for proposing amendments to the Constitution of the United States for a date and place to be determined on calling the convention. That Paragraph 2, the dimensions, exceptions. Paragraph 1 does not apply if, prior to the expiration of the 60-day period which begins on the date of the adoption of this concurrent resolution, either the House clerk provides a written report stating that there have never been unrescinded and continuing applications for a convention to propose amendments from at least 2/3 of the states on any national issue, plus the single issue of fiscal responsibility, and the House clerk includes the report detailing findings for each state. So basically what it's saying, listen, we're going to call a convention unless within 60 days after we've adopted this, the House clerk goes in and says, here is a list of states that have issued what they call plenary single issue calls that have not been rescinded. There are at least 34 of them, right? So you add them up, you take away the ones that have rescinded. Do we still have at least 2/3 of the states that have an active petitioner? Remember, I said there are people that say you cannot rescind. Well, this legislation says no. We're gonna if you've rescinded it, it doesn't count. And the House clerk then has to provide this. But what happens if they don't do it in 30 days? See, this is one little problem here. The government should always have the burden of proof. If this legislation were valid, I would say that the call should be. The House clerk must provide within 60 days a written report stating the number of unrescinded and continuing applications for plenary or fiscal responsibility issues. In other words, it shouldn't be, we're going to do this unless you can prove we can't. They should have to prove that they can. And then the other part says, each proposed amendment at the convention for proposing amendments called under this section shall be ratified by a vote of we the people in 3/4 of the states via state convention delegates who shall have no ground for reversing the vote of its millions of citizens, which is, I think, where they're bringing in Schiaffalo. And this is another thing. Congress is saying the way to ratify this is, what they want is the people to vote on it. There's a problem. The Constitution doesn't authorize a way the people voting on the resolution. Why? Because the states are the parties to the compact. So either the legislature votes or a convention votes, but they can't say, well, the people are going to vote and then the convention has to follow the people. That's unconstitutional. Now, I've made my personal opinion on these conventions before. If they're done properly, they're constitutional and they're legally binding. But they don't fix the problem. See, this amendment is they're looking for fiscal responsibility amendments. Yeah, I would like to see constitutional limits placed on Congress's borrowing authority. I'd like to see something like that. I'd like to see a prohibition from fiscal policy being done outside of the elected representatives. In other words, get rid of the Federal Reserve. But I, the question, I, the problem I have with this is, since we already don't follow the Constitution, how does changing the Constitution fix the problem? See, I don't think there are some problems with this resolution that could easily be fixed. The concern I have is, let's say we have this convention and we propose these amendments and they get ratified. Well, if Congress is going to ignore 99% of the Constitution, what makes you think they're not going to find a way to get around and ignore this? The courts are certainly going to help them, because you got to remember, the courts have already said we're going to ignore the Constitution if we think there's a significantly worthy government interest to do this. Now, I'm sure some are out there asking, but Paul, if this isn't the answer, what is? Well, I've got some thoughts on that, and I will get to them later in the program, but right now, I have to take a break. Now, if you want to find out more about what we're doing here at the Constitution Study, by all means, head to the website, constitutionstudy.com. You can find articles, videos, you can sign up for one of my mailing lists, you can donate to the cause, you can ask a question. It's all available there. Also, I'd like you to go to HealthyCell.com. See, HealthyCell is a leading innovator in supplements designed to work at the cellular level, to keep you healthy. One of the most important things you can do is make sure your immune system is working well and that it works not only when you're at home, but when you're on the go. Now, HealthyCell's Immune Super Boost combines over a dozen immune supplements into one travel-ready gel pack. I use them all the time, especially when I travel, and I recommend you do as well. Now, as an America Out Loud listener, you can get 25% off your first order if you use the code Out Loud at checkout. But please, go to HealthyCell.com, try their Immune Super Boost or any of their products. Just make sure you use that code Out Loud at checkout. That way you'll get 25% off your first order.
Trouble getting to sleep and staying asleep is infuriating. Your mind races, you toss and turn, and the harder you try, the harder it is to drift off. And today's fast-paced digital age makes it tougher. You're not alone. Poor sleep affects over 70% of us. The CDC even labeled insufficient sleep a public health epidemic. Advanced nutrition company, Healthy Cell, created REM Sleep to help you quickly fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deep, and wake refreshed. Unlike other supplements that don't work, REM Sleep is not a pill. It's a gel you swallow with ultra-absorption of science-backed ingredients, supporting all four stages of sleep using calming herbs, amino acids, and sleep hormone support. Over 1,000 reviews with an average star rating of over 4.4 proves it works. Take back your sleep. Go to HealthyCell.com and use limited-time code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. Risk-free. Love it or your money back. Guaranteed. HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD. HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD.
If you're like me, you'd like life to return to some kind of normal. You're burned out on all the fear-mongering, but deep down you try and minimize viral exposure and your risk of getting sick. You've heard it talked about time and again by respected medical professionals. Use a povidone iodine nasal solution. I don't need to tell you just how powerful a nasal cleansing formula with xylitol, povidone iodine, and vitamin D3 for immune support could be. In fact, my attorney told me not to tell you. Google it and find out for yourself. Now, get yourself a bottle of American-made Cofix RX nasal solution. Let's get out and live again. CofixRx.com. That's CofixRx.com. Use coupon code OUTLOUD and get 20% off.
Hello, I'm Ben Marble, MD, and I founded MyFreeDoctor.com as a donation-supported, faith-based nonprofit with a mission to save lives by delivering free doctor visits to patients in all 50 states of America. MyFreeDoctor.com treats a broad range of health concerns like COVID-19, long COVID, sinus infections, urinary tract infections, rashes, medication refills, and more. So please visit MyFreeDoctor.com, where we're healing America one person at a time.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. We rejoin the Constitution Study, where we read and study the Constitution, teach the rising generation to be free. Today, we're looking at the tools to save the Republic, and I got an interesting one from one of the followers of the Constitution Study. Somebody reached out on the website with an interesting question. They wanted me to take a look at the Militia Acts of 1793 and 1903 and the National Defense Act of 1916.
Specifically, he wanted to know about the constitutionality of the militia system within the United States. So I took a look. What I found was interesting, but maybe not what some people would have expected. If we're going to talk about the militias, we need a good understanding of what they are, what they can do, and what legitimate authority the United States has over them. Now, Webster's 1828 dictionary defines militia as the body of soldiers in a state enrolled for discipline, but not engaged in actual service except in emergencies, as distinguished from regular troops whose sole occupation is war or military service. The militia of a country are the able-bodied men organized into companies, regiments, and brigades with officers of all grades and required by law to attend military exercises on certain days only, but at other times left to pursue their usual occupations. So a militia is the able-bodied men of a country. They're organized into companies, regiments, and brigades. They're distinguished from regular troops by the fact that they are only required to serve in emergencies. Now, why have militias? Well, first of all, because the United States is not supposed to have a standing army. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 12 reads that Congress has the power to raise and support armies, but no appropriation of money to that use shall be for a longer term than 2 years. The idea was pretty simple. After fighting a war with England, the new states didn't want the same type of military governorships that they had as colonies. Now, while the states didn't want a large, powerful army either, they realized during the war that, while not as disciplined as the regular army, the militias could be a formidable force. This also explains the first part of the Second Amendment, which reads, "A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed." See, it was expected that each state would have their own militia, and that they were necessary to keep the individual states free. It could be security from other states, foreign governments, and yes, even the central government. By making sure the states could defend themselves, it gives the Union a powerful and distributed defense force. Of course, that's not to say the militia did not have a duty to the central government. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 15 reads, "To provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasion." While the militia was to make sure that their state was free, they could be called up to serve the Union, but only to do 3 things. Execute U.S. law, suppress insurrection, and repel invasion. It was important Congress not have complete control of the militia, or they would not be able to provide one of their most important functions, protecting the state from the central government. In order for this group of militia to be an effective national fighting force, though, they would need to have some commonality. Hence, Clause 16 states that Congress has the power to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia, and for governing such part of them as may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. So Congress determines the organization, arming, and discipline of the militia. This would help them fight effectively when they were called into service of the United States. They also set the rules governing those parts of the militia when they were in active service to the Union. Notice that the states retain the power to appoint officers and to actually handle the training and discipline of the militia. Congress may set the rules, but the states still controlled their own militia until the units are called into actual service. Then, and only then, do they fall under the national command structure. The president shall be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states when called into actual service of the United States. Doing some research, it appears that 2 militia acts were referred to as the Militia Acts of 1792. The first, which passed on May 2, 1792, had an expiration date at the end of the Congress 2 years after it was passed. This was followed by another act that was passed on February 28, 1795, and it was meant to enhance the national defense by creating a uniform militia. This second of the 2 Militia Acts of 1792 established some rather concerning standards in U.S. law. Being enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, that each and every free, able-bodied white male citizen of the respective states, resident therein, who is or shall be of the age of 18 years and under the age of 45 years, except as in hereinafter accepted, shall severely and respectively be enrolled in the militia by the captain or commanding officer of the company within whose bounds such citizen shall reside, and that within 12 months after the passing of this act. Let's start with the idea that every man, since I think we can dispense with the racist part of this act, between the ages of 18 and 45 was to be enrolled in the militia. The problem with this is that it violates the Fifth Amendment, which was ratified in December of 1791, and reads, "No person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law." Involuntary servitude, as described in this act, would certainly be a deprivation of liberty without due process of law. Granted, at that time, more people were probably willing to serve, but this section of the law does not make it optional. Militia members were expected to provide their own gear, weapons, and ammunition, and were expected to both exercise and serve with the company to which they were assigned. It should not surprise anyone that the vice president, members of Congress, the judiciary, and many other federal office holders were exempt from service in the military. Things get a bit more interesting in the second section. And be it further enacted, that whenever the laws of the United States shall be opposed or the execution thereof obstructed in any state by combinations too powerful to be suppressed by the ordinary course of judicial proceedings or by the powers vested in the marshals by this act, the same being notified to the President of the United States by an associate justice or the district judge, it shall be lawful for the President of the United States to call forth the militia of such state to suppress such combination and to cause the laws to be duly executed. Does this mean that any law of the United States can be enforced by the militia? That if a state were to find the law unconstitutional and nullify it within their borders, could the president simply call up the militia to enforce it? Possibly. After all, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 15 of the Constitution does give Congress the power to call up the militia to execute the laws of the United States. Now, if a single state stands up against a law they find unconstitutional, well, the president did have the power to call up the militia to enforce that law. What if the state's militia refused to execute the law in question, though? And if the militia of a state, where such combination may happen, shall refuse or be insufficient to suppress the same, it shall be lawful for the president, if the legislature of the United States be not in session, to call forth and employ such numbers of the militia of any other state or states most convenient thereto, as may be necessary, and the use of militia so to be called forth may be continued, if necessary, until the expiration of 30 days after the commencement of the ensuing session. Should a state militia refuse to execute federal law in their state, the president or Congress had the authority to call up militias from other states to enforce the law. This may be one reason why the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions against the Alien and Sedition Acts never went anywhere. Only two of the states opposed it, but if a larger group of states were able to nullify an unconstitutional law, it would be harder for the president or Congress, both logistically and politically, to call up the militias of other states to enforce the law. Now, those who wrote this act probably assumed that before it came to calling up of militias, the courts would offer their opinion on the law. With the corruption, politicization, and ignorance of the Constitution that runs rampant through our federal judiciary, I'm not sure the court's opinion would be of much help. Just look at all the unconstitutional opinions we've reviewed over the past few years. Now, in 1903, Congress updated the laws regulating the militia with the Militia Act of 1903. Being enacted by the Senate and the House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, that the militia shall consist of every able-bodied male citizen of the respected states, territories, and the District of Columbia, and every able-bodied male of foreign birth who has declared his intention to become a citizen, who is more than 18 and less than 45 years of age, and shall be divided into two classes, the organized militia, to be known as the National Guard of the state, territory, or the District of Columbia, or by such other designation as may be given them by the laws of the respective states or territories, and the remainder to be known as the reserve militia. See, now we have the organized militia and the unorganized militia. Now, was this law constitutional? Remember, Congress has the power to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia. So Congress can organize the militia how they want. This division between organized and unorganized militias are, I believe, attempts to deal with a problem we noted in the 1792 Act, that the regularly enlisted, organized, and uniformed active organized militia in the several states and territories and the District of Columbia, whether known and designated a National Guard, militia, or otherwise, shall constitute the organized militia. The organized militia is the one regularly enlisted, organized, and uniformed. In other words, the National Guard as we know it today. The reserve militia is every other able-bodied man who is not volunteered to serve. which leaves us with the National Defense Act of 1916. Be it enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, that the Army of the United States shall consist of the regular Army, the Volunteer Army of the Officers Reserve Corps, the Enlisted Reserve Corps, the National Guard while in the service of the United States, any such other land force as are now or may hereafter be authorized by law. Now, this law was enacted on June 3, 1916, right in the middle of World War I. This was 6 months before Germany proposed an alliance with Mexico against the United States and 10 months before the United States entered the war. It's reasonable to assume that this was Congress making preparations for a war in which the United States had declared to be neutral, but some politicians were still lobbying to join. This law gives us the organization of the militia we have today. The militia of the United States shall consist of all able-bodied male citizens of the United States and all other able-bodied males who have or shall have declared their intention to become citizens of the United States, who shall be more than 18 years of age, except as hereinafter provided, but not more than 45 years of age, and said militia shall be divided into three classes, the National Guard, the Naval Militia, and the Unorganized Militia. Here we have the two organized militias, the National Guard and the Naval Militia, and the Unorganized Militia. This can be found in U.S. law under Title 10, Section 246. The militia of the United States consists of all able-bodied males at least 17 years of age, and except as provided in Section 313 of Title 32, under 45 years of age, who are or have made a declaration of intention to become citizens of the United States, and of female citizens of the United States who are members of the National Guard. Classes of the militia are the organized militia, which consists of the National Guard and the Naval Militia, and the unorganized militia, which consists of the members of the militia who are not members of the National Guard or Naval Militia. So where does all this research leave us? Is the National Guard a constitutional entity? What about the Naval Militia? Is the division of militias into organized and unorganized legitimate? Yes, because Congress has the power to, under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 16, to provide for the organizing, arming, and disciplining of the militia. Does the Congress have the authority to call up a state's militia to enforce federal law? Yes, under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 15. This still leaves us with a couple of sticky situations, though. First, what happens if a state finds that a federal law was not made pursuant to the Constitution and refuses to execute said law within their borders? Is it possible for the president to call on that state's militia to enforce the law? This is where we need to look very closely at a particular situation. For a law of the United States to be part of the supreme law of the land, it must be pursuant to the Constitution according to the Supremacy Clause, Article 6, Clause 2. This Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges in every state shall be bound thereby, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. Now, if Congress or the president disagree with the state about the constitutionality of the law, we are supposed to have a neutral arbiter of the situation, the federal judiciary. The judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties made or which shall be made under their authority, to controversies to which the United States shall be a party. So unfortunately, the judicial branch of the federal government long ago substituted their objectivity and fidelity to the Constitution in favor of their own opinions. While I've given many examples of the dangers of such a situation, the dispute between a state and the federal government over the constitutionality of a law is possibly the most dangerous. How far would a state go, or the federal government go, to pursue their positions? Would a state attempt to secede from the Union? Would the federal government use military force to exercise their will? Would this lead to another civil war? The other sticky situation comes from the involuntary nature of the federal government's definition of the militia. I would need to do more research, but I believe that being considered a part of the militia is the legal justification for the Selective Service Registration and the conscriptions of the past. As I've already pointed out, these deprivations of liberty without due process are a violation of the Fifth Amendment. Some may blame this on the twisted character of the constitutionally created government that now resides in Washington, D.C., but we find this forced enlistment going all the way back to 1792, which brings another thought to mind. See, the Senate in 1792 had such members as Roger Sherman, Richard Henry Lee, and James Monroe. while the House of Representatives had Elias Bodineau and James Madison, and let's not forget, George Washington was the president. These men had fought for independence. They had seen the destructive elements of military rule and forced service by the British. So why would they establish a law that could be used to conscript men into military service? I cannot read their minds, but I have a possible answer. We often talk about our right to be free, but we're rarely concerned with the duties that freedom places on us. We have the right to vote, but does that not include the duty to vote for people of character who will fulfill their oaths to support the Constitution? We also talk about our right to a trial by jury, but doesn't that imply a duty not only to serve on a jury, but to seek justice in the case that we hear? See, we call ourselves the land of the free, but does that not include the duty to fight to defend that freedom? When someone wants to be naturalized as a citizen of the United States, they take an oath that includes that I will bear arms on behalf of the United States when required by law, that I will perform non-combatant service in the armed forces of the United States when required by law, that I will perform work of national importance under civilian direction when required by law. Could it be that membership in the militia is a duty all Americans should willingly fulfill? In several countries around the world, military service is compulsory. Under American law, it's only necessary to be part of the militia, to be willing, if necessary, to fight for your state and your nation. If the men who brought us the Fifth Amendment did not think it too much to ask of the citizens of the United States and of the several states that they be numbered for their defense, can we refuse to answer the call when the need arises?
So, yeah, the militia is another one of the tools we have to control our republic, to protect our rights and our liberties. We have amendments to the Constitution. We have the militia. Those are two big ones. There are more, though, but I'm going to have to take those after this break. Before I go, though, I want to remind you that the Constitution Study is just one of several voices on AmericaOutloud.com. It's one of the reasons why I go there every day to get the latest news and happenings, and I think you should join me. See, it's important that we all do our part, that we not simply sit back and expect somebody else to do this, that we share the stories, the articles, the podcasts, the videos, the views and ideas as far and as wide as we can. See, if we wish to secure the blessings of liberty, we can't hoard it all to ourselves. We have to share it, and I hope you'll join me in doing so.
Here on America Out Loud, we emphasize optimal health, and air is the most essential element for life. The average person inhales over 35 pounds of air every day. Yet we seldom think about how to rid the air of pathogens swiftly and safely when we need to. The Genesis Fogger Plus HOCL is the only way to quickly and naturally restore air to its optimal condition. Visit genesisfogger.com/outloud for a free ebook on everything you need to know about HOCL and receive a 15% discount on the Genesis Fogger with promo code OUTLOUD. With Genesis, you'll be ready for what's next.
For 40 years, alarmists have been warning of a climate catastrophe, yet none of their dire predictions have come true. Temperatures have not soared, sea level rise has not been unusual, and extreme weather events have not increased in either frequency or intensity. In short, there is no climate emergency. For 15 years, the International Climate Science Coalition has led the call for climate realism and a Made in America climate plan. A plan based on real science that responds to the real-world needs of Americans, supports economic growth, and strengthens our essential infrastructure. A plan that protects the environment and ensures that Americans can enjoy the blessings of clean air, clean land, and clean water for generations to come. It's time to put ideology and pseudoscience aside. It's time for a sensible climate plan. For more information or to donate, visit our website, icsc-climate.com.
Welcome back, everyday Americans. You've rejoined the Constitution Study. Today, we're talking about the tools that we have to protect our rights and freedoms. I've talked so far about the amendment process. I've talked about the militias. I want to work my way towards what you can do individually to protect your rights. As I go there, I'm going to take a look at a couple of interesting stories. First is a case recently heard and decided by the Supreme Court that involves parental notification when a minor seeks an abortion. Now, Missouri law requires that a woman under the age of 18 needs written consent from a parent, from at least one parent or guardian. Now, there is a way to bypass this for the minor to give consent through a legal process. Now, that law apparently neither requires nor prohibits the parental notification before the hearing, which leads to the story. Jane Doe, then 17, was pregnant, wanted a judicial bypass, and kept being told that the parents had to be notified before the hearing. Eventually, she ended up traveling to Illinois to get a judicial bypass and an abortion without parental consent or notification. She then sued the, I think it was a court clerk, for refusing to allow her to apply for the judicial bypass without parental notification. Basically, they said, if you file this request, we're going to notify your parents. She sued, by the way, under 42 U.S.C. 1983, claiming that this violated her 14th Amendment rights. I guess it's her right to liberty, but hang on. So this, by the way, went to the circuit court for the Eighth Circuit, which said, yes, this young lady, this now woman, could proceed with her lawsuit. That was then, by the way, appealed to the Supreme Court. The court basically approved the writ, said, yes, we will grant certiorari. The judgment is vacated. The case was sent back to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals with instructions to dismiss the case as moot. Now, the court didn't issue an opinion. It didn't say why. But I could see this as being moot because the woman is no longer a minor. She's no longer being damaged by this law. The interesting thing was there was one dissent to this opinion, and came from the newest justice, Justice Jackson. Now her dissent basically said, listen, this idea of vacating and disclaiming mute is being overused because now this woman cannot seek damages or appeal the facts of the case. But why did I bring this up? Because it seems to me the reflexive reaction to any infringement is to sue. We've become such a litigious society that everything seems to be solved with a lawsuit. Now, I'm not saying lawsuits are bad, but understand, when you file a lawsuit, you are asking a government actor to find the actions of another government actor not only wrong, but sufficiently wrong to make some sort of award. In this case, generally, maybe in order to act a certain way or to stop acting a certain way, frequently there's a financial, a fiscal remuneration, at least covering court costs and stuff. But you're putting your future in someone else's hands, those of judges. And by the way, it has been my experience that vast majority of the judges don't actually know what the Constitution says because they didn't study it. They studied constitutional law, what judges say about this. So you end up with a debate over whose opinion is more valid in this situation. You have lost control. Again, I'm not saying that lawsuits I'm not saying that lawsuits are not valuable, but I think we need to put them in the proper context. You are asking someone else to punish someone for violating your rights. And that, to me, is not nearly as guaranteed as I think most people would like to believe. I can't tell you the number of people that have contacted me concerned because some lawsuit or some other legal action that they knew they were in the right on, they lost. And it's lawsuits are okay, but don't think that's you protecting your rights. You're really putting your rights in the hands of somebody else. Now, there's another example that came to light. And again, my state of Tennessee, I don't know, maybe there's something in the water here. We seem to be doing pretty good when it comes to protecting people's rights. See, our governor just signed legislation, and I'm reading from Senate Bill 367. It's really simple. It deletes a certain subject, but it adds this language to part of what we call the Tennessee Code annotated. which says, a political subdivision of the state shall not adopt a policy that prohibits or has the effect of prohibiting, based on the type or source of energy to be delivered to a user, or delivered to or used by an individual consumer, the connection or reconnection of a utility service, or the sale or installation of an appliance utilized for cooking, space heating, water heating, or other end use. In other words, they just basically said, you know, all those people trying to ban gas stoves, yeah, if you are a political subdivision, if you are a government under the auspices of the state of Tennessee, you cannot create a law that prohibits or has the effect of prohibiting the delivery of a utility of or the use, the sale of an appliance or installation of appliance used for cooking or heating or any other use based on the source of energy. Now, this of course, comes in the wake of the federal government trying to ban the sale of gas stoves. I've already talked about that. The science behind that is ridiculously stupid. This has nothing to do with science. It has nothing to do with people's health. It is a blatant attempt to further restrict fossil fuel use in this country by creating another tool that you can't use it for. Now, this legislation does absolutely nothing about any federal ban on the sale of gas stoves. Understand, though, the federal ban only deals can legally only deal with interstate commerce. If a gas stove is in the state of Tennessee and then is sold and installed, federal government has no authority to deal with that, none whatsoever. Now, granted, it would make it rather difficult to get gas stoves because Tennessee is pretty much landlocked. In other words, if the ship containing the appliances were to enter the Mississippi River, dock in Memphis, and never touch another state, well, technically it couldn't because it's got to go through the waters of the Mississippi, which includes state, you know, the state of Mississippi and Louisiana. You know, it basically it says it's not going after that. Why is this important? Because there's another piece of legislation that is being worked on in the Tennessee legislature. Right, this one, this bill about not banning the sale has been signed, but the other legislation I've talked about creates a framework where the state of Tennessee can say federal action is unconstitutional and will not have effect inside of our borders. Now, again, that you still have the question of interstate commerce in this particular situation, but what we see is another example of how not simply other people, but people we hire can help protect our rights. See, this legislation I just read you, Grant, I love it because it's short, sweet, to the point. It was passed by the representatives of the people in the state of Tennessee. So for all of you that say, you know, voting doesn't matter, it doesn't matter who you vote for, here's an example of where it does. But more importantly, it's happening at the state level because you have much more impact on your state representation than you have on your federal representation. I can email my state rep and my state senator, and granted, I usually get an answer from my state rep a lot better than from my state senator, but I've yet to get a meaningful response from my U.S. representative. Doesn't happen. So what do we see? Rather than focusing on Washington, D.C., you help protect yourself by making sure your state is constitutionally sound, that it does its job to, among other things, protect you from an out-of-control central government. By the way, not just the states. Go all the way down. Go to your counties. Go to your cities. And make sure that the people representing you there are constitutionally sound. You know, when neighboring counties start implementing mask mandates, the sheriff in our county said, no, we won't because it's not constitutional. The committees in my county never passed a mask mandate. Now, I don't know how much of it was because a sheriff would refuse to enforce it, or how much of it was they were actually constitutionally sound. I imagine it's a little bit of both. But you see, county, I'm even closer. I can pick up the phone and talk to my sheriff. I can pick up the phone and talk to the county mayor. I can talk to the different county commissioners. In fact, I bumped into one the other day. We had a very interesting discussion. He gave me his card because we want to work together on some things that he may find interesting from a constitutional standpoint. So the first thing we need to understand is the most effective tools we have are the ones closest to home. They are the ones we should be using most often because they are most effective. Does it fix Washington? Does it fix your state house? Not instantaneously and not directly. But if you fix your county and you help your neighbor fix their county and you start getting several counties that start saying, wait a second, we're not going to put up with this nonsense. You can start changing the state. Not simply by having the counties perform legal actions, but if you learn how to hire good county representation, those same skills used when you're looking at state representation and federal representation. So how do we do that? How do we get there? So if the answer is grassroots, how do we get there? My answer is you start with education. See, whenever we elect somebody, I want you to think of them as an employee. We are hiring somebody to represent us. That's the definition of a republic. We take the power, we vest power in representatives who we elect to exercise that power for us. So we are ultimately responsible for who sits in all these elected positions. We need to take responsibility for that. But they each and every one of them also takes an oath to support the Constitution of the United States. And with the exception of federal offices, they also take an oath to support the Constitution of their state. Well, how do we know if they're doing that job, if they're fulfilling that oath, if we don't even know what the Constitution of the United States says? It's generally smaller and easier to read than many of the state constitutions. If we don't know if they're doing a good job, how do we know we should keep them around? So I recommend education. There's a lot of ways you can do it. I'm working on some educational tools for the Constitution study. You can always go and read my book. You can find it at the website, constitutionstudy.com. You can find it on Amazon. You can learn what the Constitution actually says. But most importantly, I don't want you to simply copy what I say. I want you to learn to study yourself. That's the program I'm working on now at the Constitution Study, to set a set of tools, a foundation by which you have enough basics to start protecting your rights, but a foundation on which you can build a more deep and thorough understanding of the Constitution of the United States, of the Constitution of your state, and other things that you encounter. You know, if we go all the way back to the beginning and the Constitutional Convention proposed amendments for fiscal responsibility, Ronald Reagan was on Johnny Carson and he was asked this question.
Now, how do you do that? I mean, how do you balance the budget?
Well, balancing the budget is like protecting your
virtue. You don't spend more than you take in, right?
Yeah, it's like protecting your virtue. You have to learn to say no.
And it's the same for protecting your rights. You have to learn to say no. But you have to do more than just a petulant child saying, no, no, no. That no has to be founded on something. I've told the story before about the mass mandate in the neighboring county and other examples where just learning to say no. When the FBI delivered a federal subpoena, or when I had to talk to the U.S. Attorney's Office, and they wanted me to fly, which would require wearing a mask and possibly getting a shot. And I learned to say no. Now, the problem is most people say no, but it's not founded in anything. It's founded on their beliefs, on their emotions, on their understanding. I want to educate people so that when they say no, they can say, and here is the law that proves that I can say no. Here is the law that you are violating by trying to make me say yes. And not simply say that it exists, but prove that it exists. The greatest tool for protecting your rights, your freedoms, and your liberty is right between your ears. It's a knowledge, it's an understanding, a basic understanding. I'm not saying you have to be a constitutional scholar like me. I'm not saying you have to spend most of your days reading and studying and analyzing this. Believe it or not, just a few key clauses out of the Constitution can give you a level of defense you wouldn't think possible. a level of freedom. There is little more freeing than looking a government actor in the eye and saying no, and then proving it. When I talk to people about this and I show it to them and the light bulb goes off, to me, that's inspiring. I've opened someone else's mind. So if you wouldn't mind, go to the website, constitutionstudy.com, sign up for the newsletter. You can also sign up for the Insider. That's where I will let people know about this new program I'm working on and the tools I'm developing to help you learn how to use the tools you already have, to not ignore them and pretend they're not there, to not make your freedom and liberty dependent on somebody else, but that you can live free and that you can live by your own freedom, not the freedom given to you by somebody else. That's why I don't want people simply quoting me. I want them to learn this for themselves so that they can develop their own ability to say no, their own way to stand against the tyranny. Now, I hope you'll come back. I hope you'll join us here at the Constitution Study every weekday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, heard on America Out Loud Talk Radio on the iHeartRadio Network. You can also listen on podcasts. The shows generally come out a day or two after they're heard on the radio, and you can use your favorite podcast app. But if you wouldn't mind, subscribe, rate the show, leave me a review. It helps other people find the Constitution Study as well. You can find all the links at the homepage at AmericaOutLoud.com. But if you want to join the movement, if you want to help other people learn to be free, then share those links, share this information. That is how you share the blessings of liberty.